You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, October 29th, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, activist trainer, working with an effort, Choose Democracy, to pair people to stop a power grab in the election, Joshua Kahn Russell. On the what if scenario, and for that matter, on the what if not scenario. Meanwhile, Trump's path becomes abundantly clear. Vote suppression. Supreme Court allows ballot counting extension to stand in North Carolina and Pennsylvania for now. Why so much attention is focused on Pennsylvania? CMS announces that Medicare and Medicaid will cover the cost of a vaccine if we get a vaccine. Meanwhile, a federal judge squeezes the Postal Service on slowdowns. And everything you wanted to know about the red mirage and the blue mirage. Speaking of knowing, we now know who the anonymous op-ed writer was. He's no hero, folks. Sanders and Warren accused New York Democrats of false advertising in 8.4 million early votes in Texas. That represents 94% of the total votes cast in 2016. Half of North Carolina voters, that's 7.3 million divided by 2, 3.65, have already voted in that state. All this and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. We are now, well, I guess, two and a half business days away from the election. I say that because if you are holding an absentee ballot, you do not have time, more than likely, to mail it at this point. In fact, a federal judge is having to admonish the Postal Service for not heeding its order to stop slowing down the mail. And so if you do have a ballot, the best thing for you to do is to drop it off at an early ballot polling place or drop-off box, or drop it off on the day of the election. But mailing it at this point is will likely lead to your ballot not being counted. Now, not for sure. And it sort of depends on where you're located, what the rules are there. But if you want to make sure that your ballot is counted, and frankly, I don't know that we've ever had a situation like this where when it's counted is going to be almost as important as if it's counted. Although when it's counted will also determine if it's counted. And we will talk more about that as the program progresses. And before we get to Joshua Kahn Russell, because there's a lot of, you know, folks, we've been talking about the scenario. We talked with Rick Hassan yesterday about the rulings in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin. And folks are vaguely aware of these scenarios and where we stand now. We will get into today. But the real question people have is not only, okay, I voted, And aside from just waiting around and feeling anxious and telling other people to vote, maybe making phone calls, and what do we do if the worst case scenario happens? What do we do if we get into a situation where we are seeing something akin to the election in 2000, and we're seeing something akin to the Brooks Brothers riot, or we're seeing something akin to what may have happened in Florida? People forget that when the Supreme Court had ended the count in Florida, simultaneously, the Florida legislature was working up a way in which to choose electors regardless of the vote. Al Gore did not concede, if I'm not mistaken. And, well, it was in the mid of December. I think it was December 14th. And a lot of people have the question, like, what do we do? And Joshua Kahn Russell is here to at least provide an answer. Of course, it's not just the president who is running for re-election on Tuesday. It's not just Joe Biden who is challenging the president. We have congressional races in every district in the country. We have Senate races in the vast majority of the states. The Senate, obviously, and I have not heard a single expert say that there is a chance of the Democrats losing control of the House. That doesn't mean it's not possible, but it's highly unlikely. The real question in people's minds is, will the Democrats take the Senate? And if the Democrats do take the Senate, we have for you two reasons why they might. Let's first go to Georgia. There are two races in Georgia. We talked about one of those races yesterday on the program, where a minister, Warnick, is right now in the lead of a field of almost 20 candidates. I don't know how many are still in there, but multiple ones, because this is a special election. There are two Republicans who are in second and third place. Doug Collins, congressman, a Trumpista pick, if you will, and Kelly Loeffler, another Trumpista pick, if you will, but she is the one who is the incumbent. She was appointed to that seat. They are in their 20s. Warnock is in the 48% and would have 50% if Matt Lieberman, Joe Lieberman's son, wasn't hanging in there for whatever reason. We don't know exactly. We don't know if he's trying to play a spoiler role, because you need 50%. In this Georgia runoff election, and I should say a special election. And if not, there will be a runoff. But there's another race in Georgia, two seats in the Senate up for grabs in Georgia. The other race is by between incumbent Perdue and challenger John Ossoff, who had also run for Congress early on in the Trump term. A lot of money was put into that race. He didn't win it. He's a couple of points behind Perdue, but this was a stunning moment from their debate. I don't know if this was from last night, I believe. Absolutely stunning moment. Here is John Ossoff with David Perdue, and it's a stunning moment.
Well, perhaps Senator Perdue would have been able to respond properly to the COVID-19 pandemic if you hadn't been fending off multiple federal investigations for insider trading. It's not just that you're a crook, Senator. It's that you're attacking the health of the people that you represent. You did say COVID-19 was no deadlier than the flu. You did say there would be no significant uptick in cases. All the while, you were looking after your own assets and your own portfolio, and you did vote four times to end protections for pre-existing conditions. Four times. And the legislation that you tout, the PROTECT Act, it includes loopholes that specifically allow insurance companies to deny policies to Georgians with pre-existing conditions. Can you look down the camera and tell the people of this state why you voted four times to allow insurance companies to deny us health coverage because we may suffer from diabetes or heart disease or asthma or have cancer in remission. Why, Senator?
There you have it. That's pretty devastating moment in that debate. It remains to be seen whether that will carry the day for John Ossoff. But David Perdue really has got down that whole going to pretend nobody's basically frying me.
He looked like unfrozen caveman lawyer there.
He really did. And that is, that's a pretty devastating moment. You got to hand it to Ossoff there for the sheer politics of it. I mean, I'm not necessarily John Ossoff is not going to be my favorite senator in the Senate. I should tell people that right now. But we shall see. We shall see what happens with that. Turning to another race, broadly speaking, the relationship that these Republican senators have with Donald Trump has been an enormous drag on their ability to get reelected if they're an incumbent. Been highly problematic. And much of this fate was sealed even before COVID. It's gotten worse, no doubt. But if you look at the polling in January, there were a lot of these Republican senators who were in big, big trouble. And it was because they could not distance themselves from Donald Trump. And one of the impacts I think that folks will look back upon on the inability of senators to distance themselves from Donald Trump was the impeachment hearings. Very difficult to vote in defense of Donald Trump in the impeachment hearings and then pivot away and try and create some distance between you and the president. There's footage, speaking of Georgia, of Kelly Loeffler pretending that she never heard the comments in the now famous tape of Donald Trump saying that he grabs them by the P word. Claims she never heard it. Had no idea what it was about. So this attempt to distance themselves from Trump is going nowhere. But it seems that also one of the problems is that when you don't attempt to distance yourself from Trump, Trump is just too much of a completely self-involved narcissist to care that you've been loyal to him. And this moment with Martha McSally in Arizona is indicative of that. Here he is, Donald Trump, at a rally in Arizona, Bullhead City, Arizona, could not be less enthusiastic about helping the incumbent senator, Martha McSally, who is in a deep deficit in her attempt to win this election. Here he is.
Great job. A woman who's running for the Senate, currently a senator respected by everybody. Her opponent wants to terminate your Second Amendment. Martha McSally. Martha. Great. Great. Martha, great. Martha, come up just fast. Quick. Come. Fast. Fast. Come on, quick. You got 1 minute. 1 minute, Martha's sake. They don't want to hear this, Martha. Come on, let's go. Quick. Come on, let's go.
All right. I'm coming. Thank you, President Trump. Arizona, we are ground zero to save the country. We have six.
There you go. Hurry up. Nobody wants to hear this. Come on. Go. You got 1 minute. Let's go.
A woman.
What's her name again? Okay, get up here. You got 1 minute. That's basically how I shuttle people off the phones in the second half of the program. Very quickly. You got 1 minute. Let's go. Sorry you're running for senator here, but I've got more important things to do than promote your candidacy. She's going to lose to Mark Kelly, who, of course, is Gabby Gifford's husband And that is why Trump makes the issue of the Second Amendment. Gabby Giffords, of course, is the victim of a horrible shooting and has recovered to a large degree, but horrible shooting, and became an advocate for sensible gun reform. One of today's sponsors is BetterHelp, who has given our audience 10% off their first month when you go to betterhelp.com/majority report. BetterHelp gives you access to your own fully licensed and accredited therapist via phone, chat, or video. A lot of therapists elsewhere have long wait lists, and it can take weeks or months before they can see you. But when you sign up with BetterHelp, they match you with a therapist based on your specific needs. You're going to be communicating with them in less than 24 hours. Look, a lot of folks under a tremendous amount of stress right now, not the least of which because of the election, but of course, the pandemic has made all of our lives difficult, and many folks feeling isolated, alienated. Perfectly reasonable reaction to this situation, but it definitely helps to have someone to talk to. And the beauty about BetterHelp is that once they connect you with the therapist, if you don't think it's a good fit for whatever reason at any time, you can switch to a new one for no additional charge. BetterHelp also tends to be more affordable than traditional therapy. And if you have a particular need for a specialist, BetterHelp has ones has specialties that range across the board, ones that may be very difficult, frankly, to find in your area. BetterHelp is giving everyone in our audience 10% off your first month when you go to betterhelp.com/majority report. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/majority report. We'll put the link in our podcast and YouTube description, and we'll even put it with the https://, so that it's clickable. So check it out there. Also, just a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. In the meantime, I'd like to welcome to the program Joshua Kahn Russell. Joshua is a social movement strategist. He's been an organizer for 20 years. And Joshua, you're supporting an initiative called Choose Democracy. Welcome to the program. Tell us about what Choose Democracy is.
Thanks for having me on, Sam. Choose Democracy started in late August when a number of organizers across the country who come out of different movements, the labor movement, the climate movement, others, including some OGs, like, for example, coordinators of Mississippi Freedom Summer in 1964, people who were leaders in the civil rights movement. We got together and saw the very real possibility of an extra legal power grab this election. And we wanted to start to prepare for it. And so in order to prepare for it, we built out a pledge as an organizing tool, which I can talk about in a second. But our goal was really to both psychologically prepare people to say that, yes, this can happen here. In fact, it already has. You referenced the 2000 election, which we also think is an example of what we're calling a coup, which we're defining a coup as either if someone claims victory before all the votes are counted, or if Trump tries to stop the counting of ballots, or in the variety of scenarios in which he might refuse to accept a loss. And in
Let
addition
me interrupt
to that
you for one second.
Yeah.
I want to make sure that we have a scope of what constitutes an extra legal power grab. All those scenarios you're talking about, I think are at least ones that will present itself very sort of clearly to Americans. But for instance, and I'm going to be talking about this a little bit later, more specifics, but the Supreme Court declined to hear a challenge to the extension of the counting of the ballots in Pennsylvania. Right. Mm-hmm. The state Supreme Court of Pennsylvania had said you're going to have 8 days to count these ballots. The Republicans are challenging that because the legislature says, I think you only get 2 or 3 days. And there's going to be hundreds of thousands of ballots that are coming in. There's a court that has already said we're going to sequester those ballots. So there's going to be two piles of ballots. There's going to be ballots that get in by 8 p.m. on election day. And then there's going to be a whole nother trove of ballots that will be postmarked on election day, but may arrive the next morning, may arrive later that day. And it's conceivable that the Supreme Court, and they've indicated this, may come back and say those other ballots, you don't count.
Mm-hmm.
How, like, give us the scope. I mean, is that constitute in your mind one of these extra legal power grabs, even though it's by the Supreme Court, right? I mean, that's supposedly the source of our law in some instances.
Yeah, it absolutely would cross one of those red lines, we're looking at these red lines both from a perspective of how can we organize around them, right? So there's all kinds of shenanigans happening already. But for us, it's once the rules are set, basically by starting on November 4th, moving forward, if they try to change the rules through whatever mechanisms, and we anticipate them going through the courts. I mean, Trump has built a legal machine for this over the last year. Yep. And that's why we started preparing in August, is to say that, not only should we get ready for it, but actually we can ground our strategy in history. That's the reason why we use the word coup. It's not to be hyperbolic or to conjure up tanks rolling in the streets or anything like that. It's to say that there's a whole body of research about what is successful resistance in coups. And to us, the key distinction is that what we're about to probably step into, possibly, I hope not, is a contest for legitimacy. And when there are two competing claims to the throne, there are a lot of roles that regular people can play. And we think if in 2000, for example, there was anticipation around this and people started organizing in advance and we didn't depend on the Democratic Party to either capitulate or not, people could have found their agency, because the one thing that coup plotters want is for people to think that we have no role or no power in this kind of situation and we just need to kind of bite our nails and sit back and depend on the courts.
So the use of the term coup is as much for the response as it is to describe the event itself.
Yeah, it's a both and. To describe the event itself, we do think the language of a stolen election or election interference or tampering, that the American public is pretty inoculated against that. And instead, we're trying to find what are the red lines that we think most Americans could get behind, because what we're going to need to be doing is defending democracy as a whole in this kind of moment. And if we retreat into, I've been an activist my whole life. And if we treat into activist mindset where people just go out into the streets protesting Trump, that's not going to accomplish our goals. That's just going to feed existing narratives of polarization. And we need a different strategy.
Let's talk about what that strategy is, because, I mean, on its face, right? You're not going to, if it is a question of convincing or of completing claims of legitimacy, like, who needs to be convinced? Because I'm just thinking in terms of raw numbers, right? Well, the 46% of the vote, I mean, nobody anticipates Donald Trump getting more than 46, 48% of the vote. I mean, it's just not, there's no one who makes that claim. And in fact, a lot of this voter suppression is a function of the Trump campaign understanding that. So you're not going to convince those 46 or 47% of voters, I guess. And presumably the most you can do is convince the 51% of people who vote for Biden, let's say, right? This is hypothetical. But you may lose some of those people just because, like, oh, we don't want to fight. But that's not the way it works, is it? I mean, it's a much smaller group of people we're talking about who bestow this legitimacy. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. We're drawing on the canon of what's called civil resistance. And so there's a theory of power behind that, which is that power doesn't just reside sort of isolated among politicians or business leaders, that any government depends on the consent of a number of different institutions and people to participate in the system in order to carry out orders, in order to help the thing function. So if you think of it as, we do with Choose Democracy, one of the things that we're doing is we've been training thousands of people. And in our trainings, we talk about power as there's, imagine that a regime, there's like a roof, right? So there's a roof that's the government. It depends on a number of different pillars holding it up. So those pillars are labor, it's capital, it's the media, it's the military, it's the police. There's a variety of pillars, institutional pillars, that hold up the edifice. Some of those pillars are within our control. And some of those, or well, let me rephrase that. Some of those pillars we have some impact on.
Right.
Some of those pillars we do not. And so the strategy is to target the pillars that we do have some kind of control over or some kind of impact on, and to try to pull them out from under the roof. And when you do that, the whole thing collapses. You can't go. So for example, you know, in 1920 there in Germany, there was an attempted coup. There was this guy, Wolfgang Kopp, who tried to basically walk into the Capitol building and seize the government. He had a number of institutions on his side, and all the government workers went on strike. There was no one there to even type up his manifesto. Newspapers refused to run his declarations. And through mass, in their case, it was a general strike, the coup was defeated in 4 days. And so we're drawing on a lot of different, whether it's Thailand in 1992 or Argentina in 1987, we're drawing on that tradition. And there's an escalatory arc to get there. And so If I can describe the tactics that would fit in that strategy for a second, we're in phase one right now.
Well, oh, yeah. let me before we get to the tactics, just so I understand from a strategic standpoint, when we look at those pillars of society that you're talking about, the police, well, I don't know. I mean, maybe we should go first through those pillars that you suggest that we have influence over. Right. I mean, the media stands out for me and labor stands out for me. I mean, in the sense that we have the ability, and I think there's been at least significant unions who have said, like, we're involved in something to this effect. What mm-hmm. else besides the media and labor? And we only have so much influence over the media, I guess, or labor for that matter. But where else? Like, I mean, do we have more influence over the military than we do over, let's say, the police? Or does that even break down? Are we talking about municipal police or the new federales that the Trump administration seems to be rolling out? I mean, just give us a sense of where of is there a rating? Do we have X percentage on this? And then let's talk about the tactics.
Yeah, and I'll give examples with each of these pillars in kind of that arc of escalation.
Okay.
So let me just start with saying where we're at now. So the phase that we're in now is actually not a civil resistance phase. We're not there yet. It hasn't happened yet. So we're in a civic engagement phase, which is about voting, which is about people signing up to be poll workers. And we're working with a number of different groups who are doing things like de-escalation training so that people can go to the polls and be protected there if Proud Boys or militias or whoever show up to intimidate people. That's one part of the infrastructure. And also what we're doing right now is training people to be building action groups to target different kinds of pillars depending on where they are. So we're quickly after the election moving into phase two, where the arc of civil resistance kicks in. So what's happening on the way there, for example, is so one pillar or one is the bureaucracy of federal workers, right? So there's a number of groups right now. There's a group, for example, called Protect the Election that's doing a letter writing campaign to strengthen the spines of election officials to basically let them know they have support to, if they get an extra legal or illegal order to throw out ballots or something like that, that there's people watching, and to start to build that narrative and support for them, right? So they're one of the kind of key groups in the earlier phases. There's also groups.
Let me just add something here. Like, you know, I'm starting to read of things like, you know, if the Supreme Court says don't count those ballots, let's say in Pennsylvania, the election officials could just say, like, well, I'm counting them. And the idea, and what happens is the Supreme Court can say, like, those are not valid ballots because they weren't postmarked by the right day. It's just that the mail screwed up and got there late. And if the election officials say, well, all right, I mean, that's you can say that. But I can also tell you that these ballots, 10,000 for Joe Biden, 3,000 for Donald Trump. And that fact that announcement, the reality of that has a power that in some way is in conflict with whatever the Supreme Court says about those not being ballots that you should count. I mean, once they get counted, people know, and that drives like this intensity towards legitimization.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And so a lot of these tactics are around making it easier for people to defect and raising the cost for people to go along with it. So another one, for example, that's happening right now is we have a pledge on our website. And the pledge is that first, we're going to vote. Second, we're going to refuse to accept any election result until all the votes are counted. The third is that we will nonviolently take to the streets if a coup is attempted. And then the fourth is if it gets there, we will shut down the country if necessary. And that pledge is an organizing tool that now 35,000 people have signed it, and they're using it as a mechanism to pressure politicians to sign the pledge so that they can also be held accountable to those red lines. So that's another thing that's happening, and pressuring politicians to not go along with those orders is one example of one of the pillars, right? So then after November 4th, there's a group called Protect the Results, which is a big center-left coalition of over 100 organizations that are going to be having rallies and mass actions all around to basically say count every vote to set the tone. And then from there, depending on how it escalates, and there's numerous potential scenarios, there are potential actions at the Board of Elections, right? So, which is another, like to prevent, you mentioned in the intro, the Brooks Brothers riot. So we ask, what are the actions that actually can defend the counting of ballots if at the Board of Elections, the other side tries to violently, you know, break into offices, whatever. And so those actions look like, you know, how can we accessibly, you know, bring, you know, balloons and pizza and families to hang out and support the Board of Elections to be able to count the ballots and then be in dialogue with the community if they get other orders, again, to support people resisting illegal orders. And if it escalates from there, then that's where we can talk more about the pillars question, which is that then we're in a real non-compliance situation where we are talking about rolling strikes. And so you want me to give some examples?
Yeah. I just wanted to like, you know, so I mean, people should picture this, like the intensity of, you can look back at that footage of the Brooks Brothers riots, even though they're all like in, you know, casual Friday wear, or they've, you know, taken their suits off. Like the idea that if there were like families there with balloons and pizza, it would have diffused the pressure they were putting on. I mean, those people who were counting those ballots were afraid. They were afraid, yeah. Even though they're looking out at, you know, a bunch of lawyers, they don't know. I mean, you know, there's a bunch of people yelling at them and there's nobody there. There's no sense for those, you know, people in the room counting that like, hey, is anybody watching this? Is like, what, like what's happening? And mm-hmm. the sort of injection of like sort of normalcy or just like, you know, nice people. I mean, I don't know how else to say this, you know, just de-escalates the situation and relieves the pressure on people. I mean, we could be looking at, I mean, I suspect this time around, let me ask you this in terms of that stage. Has your organization, because I've been speculating for a while that if I was Roger Stone, let's say, who was involved in the Brooks Brothers riot, and in terms of like sitting in a van, orchestrating it in some respects, he's certainly incentivized to do the same thing. He has a relationship with the Proud Boys. That is clear. The Proud Boys seem to be very gung-ho to get involved in these type of things, but they're not going to be at every, they're not going to be at every, you know, election board in the country. They probably have a list of, I don't know, 5-10 counties in the country. And, you know, a good political reporter could tick them off the top of their head where the election could turn, right? We only have so many number of swing states. And within that, we have so many number of counties that are swing counties. And I don't know if it's Macomb County in Michigan or Bucks County in Pennsylvania. Do you folks have an idea of what those counties are? And do you have specific plans for those counties? Like how granular? I'm not saying you have to name the counties, probably don't want to. But how granular have you guys gotten with this?
There are groups in the coalition that we're a part of who are working in every swing state and getting very granular. So groups like Protect the Results, groups like Hold the Line are doing that. That's not what we see our particular role is as Choose Democracy. But I'm quite hopeful that there are now there are hundreds of organizations around the country who are starting to organize with this strategy, right? So to be clear about, because the reality is that it's different county by county. Election right. law is different county by county. And so the phase that we're talking about now is basically between, you know, early November to December 8th or 14th, where everything is on the local level, everything is on the county level. And what we have on our site, so when people sign up for the pledge, not only do they get opportunities to participate in trainings that we're doing every other day, but in addition to that, we have an action hub where we're going to be amplifying the actions that a lot of these other groups are planning. We are not trying to like coordinate every action across the country,
right?
But we are amplifying the ones that we think are in accordance with this strategy that we think regular people can plug into, people who are not activists, people who've never done this before, in a way that feels both, you know, is COVID minded, is de-escalation minded, is mindful of, you know, confrontations that can happen. And so so the answer is yes. And especially in places like Florida, which is where I know the best of what grassroots groups are doing right now.
Right.
So, yeah.
Okay. So now take us to this rolling strategy. So we're past that. The election happens. The counting either stops or doesn't stop. In certain areas, there is a clear indication that by some mechanism or another, there are a lot of uncounted votes, and those uncounted votes would have a different outcome of this election than has been announced and established by the president, let's say. Mm-hmm. And so what happens then?
So that's when we go into shut down the country mode. And so what that looks like, you know, to be clear, only 10% of the workforce is unionized. Some people are using the word general strike. We think that might be a little ambitious and also not necessary. That right now there's a number of different labor groups. So we were very excited when a few weeks ago, the Rochester AFL-CIO, their Central Labor Council, made a declaration that if there was election interference, they would go on strike. They represent 70,000 workers, and they were calling on the rest of the AFL-CIO to make a similar commitment that they would be doing a general strike if we were to get to this stage. In addition to them, there's a number of other great signs from labor. For example, the National Union of Healthcare Workers Executive Board just signed a pledge that is, you know, similar to the Choose Democracy pledge. The Detroit postal workers are printing up the actual Choose Democracy pledge on their union letterhead. The Emergency Workplace Organizing Committee, which is a collaboration between the electrical workers and DSA, is holding convenings of labor leaders to talk about this. So there's a lot of examples of
Have tactical shutdowns. You could have the flight attendants.
Exactly.
We're not flying. Boom. I mean, they were the ones who, in my estimation, ended the government shutdown a couple of years ago.
Okay. And Sarah Nelson is in these conversations.
I have no doubt. So, all right. Well, I know you only have a couple of minutes here. So what we're looking at is shutting down the country, but not necessarily with a general strike, with key areas that will basically paralyze, in some respects, certain functions of the country.
Yeah.
And then what supplements that?
So there's lots of ways that people who, you know, so for example, there are lots of groups. Sunrise Movement is organizing a youth strike of people not participating in schools, et cetera. There are options for what's called a consumer strike, which is kind of like a generalized boycott over the holiday season. And so that's an example of so capital is another one of those pillars, right? And that if they're always hedging their bets and seeing what level of risk of how they can make the most money. And if if we are increasing the level of risk and people during the holiday scenario are refusing to shop and buy things, it could swing where capital lands on this thing, for example. And so it's about understanding where we have leverage and organizing around that. And so there's also another thing that I'll say is that the actual career government workers, government bureaucrats have a really important role to play, and they are also organizing around this strategy. There's a group called Feds for Democracy and another group called Democracy Kitchen. They're doing trainings with another group called Shutdown DC, which is like a direct action organization that has the capacity to basically, through street blockades and things like that, shut down Washington, DC. At each stage of this, part of what we've learned from coups in other countries is the tectonic shifts that can happen in a society make room for unlikely alliances, and things can change very rapidly. And so when there's a logic in place, the logic of noncompliance, it's something that a lot of other groups can kick into. And so we're both looking at these pillars, but in general, if we get to that stage, we're talking about shutting down maintenance, trash, transit, mail, whatever, in order to stop the country from moving, in order to increase the stakes for, you know, so the last thing I'll share is that, you know, the courts, including the Supreme Court, they're not apolitical bodies. They're going to make a different calculation on the way they vote if they're seeing the country be shut down versus whether they think that everyone will just accept the results they give.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, that frankly, that was the one of the reasons why I was saying, you know, to people who are disaffected Democratic voters who might say, look, well, I'm in a blue state. I don't need to vote for Joe Biden. I can, you know, do a more performative vote. And in this instance, the difference between Joe Biden winning by a million popular votes across the country, even if he loses in a state by, I don't know, 500 votes, versus Joe Biden winning 10 million votes, that's going to weigh on the courts. They can't pretend like they're not aware of what the implications of their rulings are going to have. And if there is a big difference between pissing off 10 million voters versus a million voters, as it were. Okay, I'm listening to this. I'm at home right now. I may not be a member of a union. I may not be any of the sort of the cohorts that you mentioned, but the general gist is noncompliance. And maybe I'm looking at my PTA or I'm looking at some other organization I'm part of, and I can say like, oh, wait, we can fit into that paradigm. Where can people go to get more information about this to see if their group's involved or how, if they have the ability, they have some type of group that they can get involved at one point? What's the best clearinghouse for this?
So if you go to choosedemocracy.us and sign the pledge, on our list, we're both sending out training opportunities. So we're going to keep doing trainings on how to engage. There's also training manuals. There's a great manual called Hold the Line that gives very easy step-by-step instructions. You don't have to have had experience with any of this. That helps people, no matter what their station in life is, engage. And then also, as things unfold, if you're on the list, we have an action hub that will be sending out different action opportunities for people to plug into as well.
Joshua Con Russell, fascinating stuff. Thank you so much. We will put a link to that on our website and into the podcast description, all the descriptions that we have. Really appreciate your time today, and good luck. It's comforting at least to know that people are all on it. You know what I mean? And that if you are feeling frustrated and nervous about this outcome, you have an outlet. You already have that, but I'm talking to other folks. Joshua, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
I'm so grateful to be on. I love your show. Daily listener.
Oh, well, thank you, Joshua. All right. We're going to take a quick break. Be right back in just a moment. So let's talk a little bit more about the scenario that Joshua was talking about. One of these sort of, I guess, extra legal power grabs. I had mentioned that there was a Supreme Court ruling or I should say a refusal to rule in some respects, from the Supreme Court regarding two states that very well may play pivotal roles in the outcome of this election. The big one is Pennsylvania. Donald Trump has been keyed in on Pennsylvania. We already know there have been reports, a piece that was in by Bart Gellman in the New Yorker, I believe it was, magazine, that in Pennsylvania, the Pennsylvania lawmakers have already begun to contemplate the scenario where the resolution of their state election is pushed so far into the future that they rely on the demand that they have electors to send to Washington, D.C. by the third week of December. This is what happened in the 2000 in Florida. It was December 14th, I believe it was, that Al Gore conceded after the Supreme Court had said they were not going to count the count any more ballots in Florida. And it was December 13th, excuse me. While that was happening in Tallahassee, the capital of Florida, the Republican legislature had already begun the process of choosing Republican electors who were going to vote for Bush regardless of what the outcome was. In this year, we have Wisconsin, North Carolina, Michigan, and potentially now Pennsylvania, where we will have a scenario where they will, where the question of what ballots to count will be up in the air and being bounced around by the courts enough that they could theoretically use that opportunity to say, well, look, we're the state legislature. The Constitution does not say that we actually have to follow the outcome of the vote. We're convinced that the outcome of the vote is in doubt in some manner or another. We're going to simply vote on who the electors are, and all of our electors are going to support Donald Trump. The right-wing media, I mean, obviously Donald Trump has been promoting this for this sort of mentality for some time. Here's Donald Trump in Las Vegas, Nevada. He is saying he hopes the courts won't allow vote counts past Tuesday. Now, this is a really important distinction. The question isn't whether people can vote after Tuesday. The question is whether votes that have been that have been cast before Tuesday can be counted. Now, this happens all the time. It happened in California. It happens in California. Martha McSally lost in her race to Kristen Sinema in Arizona 2 weeks after the election. Al Franken, when he won in Minnesota in 2012, was not seated, 2008, was not seated for months because they were still counting ballots, recounts and whatnot. So the idea of counting ballots after Election Day is not a novel one. The idea of stopping the counting because we don't want to count past Election Day is the only thing that's radically new. Here's Donald Trump promoting that in Las Vegas.
Hopefully, the few states remaining that want to take a lot of time after November 3rd to count ballots, that won't be allowed by the various courts, because, as you know, we're in courts on that. We just had a big victory yesterday in Wisconsin on that matter. So hopefully that won't be happening. Okay.
And the victory he's talking about in Wisconsin was the Supreme Court. We mentioned that yesterday with Rick Hassan, that the Supreme Court said a state court cannot overrule its own legislature on this regard, even if it is inconsistent, or I should say a federal court cannot overrule the state legislature on this, even if it is inconsistent with the idea of letting people vote. And the question at hand with North Carolina and Pennsylvania is whether a state Supreme Court in Pennsylvania can say, because of COVID, And because of the state's constitution, which says that we need to provide a free and fair election, that we need a couple more days for people to be able to count the votes, not to cast a vote. And in North Carolina, it is a question whether election officials can make that determination. The Supreme Court has let them stand for now. But again, we said that they're sequestering those ballots that are counted after 8 p.m. Or I should say come in after 8 p.m. on Election Day. They've been cast on Election Day or prior to Election Day, but they don't arrive because the mail is late. We not only have Donald Trump out there saying that you shouldn't count ballots past November 3rd, we're now seeing his mouthpiece, Fox News, do the same thing. Here's Fox and Friends. This morning, conflating the idea of counting ballots that have been cast on or before November 3rd with the idea of counting ballots that are cast after November 3rd.
I will say this. I was stunned to see that number that you mentioned, Ainsley, is a lot. But all of last election in 2016, 139 million. So we're past the halfway point. The people voted already. What I find discouraging is that the Supreme Court is letting North Carolina and Pennsylvania extend the time in which they're counting ballots. Are you kidding? Hey, guys, there's a siren on. If you have a ballot, mail it in. What's taking so long?
Yeah.
Why do you need extra days?
Great question.
Nobody needs extra days. It's a function of the post office. We have a federal judge who has not only ruled that the post office needs to stop purposely slowing down the mail, but that the post office needs to listen to the federal judge who first said, you got to stop slowing down the mail. They wouldn't listen the first time around. So it's not a question of casting your ballot in the right amount of time. It's a question of whether the facilities that people are relying on and have been told to rely on do their job and deliver the ballot. That's the question here. But they're already starting to conflate it, right? Like if you mail your ballot in today, and it doesn't get there till Wednesday, according to Fox News. Well, then you have some type of moral failing. Your ballot shouldn't count. Judge Emmett Sullivan of the District Court for the District of Columbia had already reversed mail collection limitations set by Donald Trump's Postmaster General Louis DeJoy. On Tuesday of this week, Sullivan granted a plaintiff's plea, so this is a voters, essentially, to actually comply with that order. There are four voters. They claim that the U.S. Postal Service has been dragging its feet in complying with the order that Sullivan had issued to speed up, to stop slowing down the mail. And so Sullivan basically said, here is a detailed list of demands, which I am insisting that the U.S. Postal Service use to comply with his order. They have to send directives around to personnel that are explicit and make it clear that mail carriers are not to follow the Postmaster General's instructions that would slow mail delivery. And those directives were supposed to be sent out by yesterday morning. We have a federal judge who's not only telling the post office to stop slowing down the mail, but to actually listen to him when he says stop slowing down the mail. So the idea that people are being shirking their duty by putting in ballots is absurd. All right, we have one last clip I want to get in before we run out of time. We've all heard quite a bit about the Hunter Biden emails And the problem that the right is having and Donald Trump is having is that there's nothing in those emails that purports to do what it says it does, which is to implicate Joe Biden in any type of scandal. We're not going to have time to play the clip now. We'll have to wait for the second half of the show. But Tucker Carlson is sort of carrying this ball forward. We will play the clip in a bit, but all you're seeing now, and I think there are some valid complaints that Twitter and Facebook prevented the initial story by the New York Post from being linked to or passed around, even though we now know that Wall Street Journal, Fox News, every other, even I'm not sure I would necessarily say that Fox News is a reputable news outlet, but any other endeavor that attempts to purport it is a reputable news outlet passed on this story, because at the end of the day, there is nothing there that implicates Joe Biden, and there is nothing there that we didn't already know in terms of Joe Biden's son, Hunter, traded off of the Biden name to get work that he otherwise wouldn't have gotten. And that is a problem not only in the context of politics, a problem in the context of our entire society, in my estimation. It's also a massive problem in the context of the Trump administration, except for he is president. Joe Biden is not president. Joe Biden was not vice president at the time that Hunter Biden, that these emails purport to discuss. But the narrative that they're pushing is that now it's not the emails. It's that nobody talked about the emails. Nobody talked about the non-story enough. And that is unfair. And that is why this election, according to them, is somehow rigged. Because nobody talked about the non-story. Nobody covered the non-story enough. We'll get to that in a moment. Just a reminder, if you have a ballot, an absentee ballot, go and bring it to a polling place now. Make sure you vote 4 days before the election, folks. See you tomorrow. For those of you who are sticking around, let's play this. Let's play this Tucker Carlson video. This is pretty stunning stuff, because this is completely consistent with what the right is doing now. There's really no story in the documents or the emails. But the story is that nobody's talking about the non-story. Or the story is that someone's trying to prevent us from talking about the non-story. Here's Tucker Carlson bringing up something that seems very, very eerie and scary.
There's always a lot going on that we don't have time to get to on the air. But there is something specific going on behind the scenes right now that we did feel we should tell you about. So on Monday of this week, we received from a source, a collection of confidential documents related to the Biden family. We believe those documents are authentic, they're real, and they're damning. At the time we received them, my executive producer, Justin Wells, and I were in Los Angeles preparing to interview Tony Bobulinski about the Biden's business dealings in China, Ukraine, and other countries. So we texted a producer in New York and we asked him to send those documents to us in L.A. And he did that. So Monday afternoon of this week, he shipped those documents overnight to California with a large national carrier, a brand name company that we've used, you've used countless times with never a single problem. But the Biden documents never arrived in Los Angeles. Tuesday morning, we received word from the shipping company that our package had been opened and the contents were missing. The documents had disappeared. Now, to its credit, the company took this very seriously and immediately began a search. They traced the envelope from the moment our producers dropped it off in Manhattan on Monday all the way to 3:44 a.m. yesterday morning. That's when an employee at a sorting facility in another state noticed that our package was open and empty. Apparently, it had been opened. So the company's security team interviewed every one of its employees who touched the envelope we sent. They searched the plane and the trucks that carried it. They went through the office in New York where our producer dropped that package off. They combed the entire cavernous sorting facility. They used pictures of what we had sent so that searchers would know what to look for. They went far and beyond, but they found nothing. Those documents have vanished. As of tonight, the company has no idea and no working theory even about what happened to this trove of materials, documents that are directly relevant to the presidential campaign just 6 days from now. We spoke to executives at that company a few hours ago. They seemed baffled and deeply bothered by this, and so are we.
All right, Brendan, can we play the clip where he plays, where he shows us those documents that are going to have all this impact on the election? I mean, he said he took pictures of it, right? I mean, they said that they took pictures of those documents. That's what they showed them. I mean, because of course, if you're getting a trove of documents that you think are going to impact the outcome of the election, of course you make photocopies. Maybe you'll take scans, like with this special device called the phone that you can scan things with. And so he said that they have these things. That's what they showed to, they had pictures. That's what they showed the company. Can we run the clip where he talks about what's in these documents that are blockbuster?
I don't know if there is one, Sam.
Oh, well, that's weird.
Yeah. I mean, oh,
so this is just a story about supposedly Tucker saying that somebody's reading my texts and knew that there was sensitive information in this, in these, in this envelope, and they intercepted it on the way to the facility.
There's nothing to fear.
Here's Tucker's text with a Salon writer, Roger Sullenberger.
Oh, I see. So Roger Sullenberger, hi, Tucker, it's Roger. Did you make copies of those documents or did anyone take photos? Of course. The point is someone's reading our text. This is according to Tucker Carlson. So what we're to believe is not just that someone's reading Tucker's texts. They're reading Tucker's texts, send this stuff via FedEx. Then there's a surveillance team that is intercepting. They must have, like, I mean, can you imagine the core of agents that the that whoever's reading the texts have, that they can go and pose as a, that they're working at the, let's say it's, I don't know, FedEx or DHL, right? Or whatever it is, or UPS. There has to be somebody in the inside who is working there, who is positioned in such a way that they can receive the package after it's picked up at Fox News on 6th Avenue in New York. How do I know that? And then they took it, they ripped open, because any of these places that that you ship stuff, it's like, it's really sealed, right? I mean, it's not, if the producer remembered to seal the envelope, and they rip it apart, and then they just stick it back into the into the process to be, I guess, scanned, and nobody notices until it gets to a certain facility that it's been ripped open. I mean, this sounds sort of fantastical to me.
There could be a rational explanation for it, though. USPS hired some Antifa people to go through conservatives' mail, and it's not, there's nothing insidious about that. It's just part of longstanding efficiency upgrades that the Postal Service has been looking at for a long time. So there's nothing to look into with it, but that might be, that might explain it.
Well, that's true of the Postal Service, but he said it was a reputable company. He said it was a big company. It wasn't necessarily the U.S. Post Office. Now, maybe UPS is starting to hire Antifa people who are picking that out, who saw, you know, Tucker's name or something on it. But here's the question, like, why wouldn't you send these documents as, like, well, I guess they do have them. They scanned them and they wanted them. Like, why would you not, if you've taken pictures and you've scanned them, why wouldn't you just send that? Why do you need the actual documents themselves? I mean, it's like, I can understand, like, oh, well, we want to take pictures of it because we want to show them on television. Well, can't you just shoot them in your studios in New York? I mean, the reason why I'm really skeptical about this is because Tucker is a liar. He lies about things on national television. We've seen him do it. And it's quite possible that they mailed a package and something happened to it. But the idea that people are watching his like text, I mean, this is just absurd. Where's the bag? Why does he show the bag in front of people? How it's been ripped open of all the documents. I mean, if there is somebody surveilling Tucker Carlson's texts and has the ability to intercept, like, how would they know? Did Tucker text, like, send it DHL? Wouldn't you just say, like, overnight it to your producer? I mean, I could see, like, if I asked, you know, Brendan, if I said to you, Brendan, I want you to send me that stuff from the office and send it to me. Use FedEx. But if you're working in a major corporation, it's like you take it to the mail room. You don't say like, oh, here's my personal FedEx account number or something. I don't know. It seems very, very, very suspicious story. But who knows, right? Stranger things have stranger things happened? Probably. Guys, thank you for joining us today. The crew will be in to do the fun half. Matt Binder is connecting as we speak. Just a reminder, your support makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, don't forget, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. What else do we have for you? Don't forget, AM Quickie is available. You can find that at amquickie.com. And check out Nomi's show today. It is, you can find it at youtube.com/the Nomi Key Show. And, Jamie, what's on the Antifada today?
Well, this week on the Antifada, we have a very spooky, very fun Halloween episode. We talk about two different horror movies with my friends Heather Fortune and Leslie Lee III from Struggle Session. The first movie is Host. It was filmed during COVID. It's all takes place over Zoom. It's very frightening. And the second movie is Society, which is a real cult classic with strong class themes about how the rich are a slimy race of incest monsters. So that's up now. Patreon.com/TheAntifada. And also tomorrow, we have a bonus coming out for all our patrons, which is on the film Beetlejuice. And that features the Lit Crit guy, who is a really good guest who we've had on in the past. So check that out.
Matt Binder, how are you, Matt?
I'm doing good, Sam. Did you see, by the way, that UPS announced that they had found Tucker Carlson's secret document package?
No, is that right?
Well, they claim they found it, and they are, you know, they expedited the search and they have located the packet, the documents.
Well, that's not possible.
Well, Will Sommer just tweeted out. Oh, wait, no, that was more recent. Never mind. Excuse me.
Wow. No, I didn't know that. So that means that we got to put this as an addendum onto that video. So Matt Binder has just told me that they have found the documents. Well, obviously what happened is the people reading Tucker's texts took the documents, took their mini camera, took pictures of all the documents, but they had to do it in the back room. And then they placed them somewhere that they could find them.
These guys, right? They think of everything.
I wonder if Tucker Carlson's going to go on a show tonight and say, hey, remember yesterday where I made it sound like I was a victim of like some type of spy operation? It just turned out like sometimes you put stuff in like FedEx and it falls out.
You can't trust the mail.
Can't trust the mail.
I mean, they're really pushing it too with the timing of all this. I mean,
well, wait a second though. If it arrives after the time it was supposed to, you're not allowed to read it, right? Isn't that the rule that we have with the votes? So I don't think he could actually look at the documents anymore.
If only it worked that way, right?
Yes. Matt, what's happening on Doomed?
Are you coming to visit the show on election day?
It's the
in-year
anniversary.
Wouldn't miss it for the world. Is this the first 12-hour show you've done since I was there?
I think so.
The Occupy Wall Street 12-hour show we did?
Yeah.
Jeez.
That was
pretty... That was 2012.
I feel like at the end of that, I said I could go another 5 or 6 hours, didn't I?
I think so. I mean, you were really ready to go. you were hopped up and ready to go. The Majority Report gives you power. The longer you do the show, the more powerful you become. That's just how it goes.
It's true. By 12 hours, I may end up doing 16. We'll see.
Right.
Yeah, Sam's near his final form when we near 3 o'clock, actually.
Exactly. Oh, that's God. When I'm like, I have to like slow down. What's happening?
The Mueller hearings 12 hours, or did it just feel like 12 hours?
What's that?
That
was like seven.
Oh, okay.
The what?
The Mueller hearings. Mueller.
Testimony's harder to listen to than
just like
doing the show, though.
24.
I don't even remember that. I don't remember it at all.
I do.
Still scarred.
That's because Russiagate was a lie, Sam. It was all a hoax. It never happened.
So what's happening on Doomed?
On Doomed this week, I had Ali Vargas, who gave us an on-the-ground report from Bolivia, what happened in the Bolivian elections, and you know, a really sad story, too, just happened yesterday. I had him on the show yesterday. Labor leader, the coal miner, whose video went viral. He was a big MAS supporter. He was considered one of the future young rising stars on the left. He died yesterday after being attacked by fascist groups over there.
Oh,
so, so, you know, just because the election is over and there's a winner doesn't mean that the far right over there has thrown in the towel. They're still pushing for all sorts of, you know, terrible things, including attacking some future leftist leaders in Bolivia. Also, on the show, I did a second episode on the deepfake, the deepfake apocalypse that we were all supposedly waiting for that never came. And I dive into why that was and why cheap fakes and, you know, cheap memes did the job just, you know, better than even deepfakes probably could have for much cheaper to spread misinformation in this election season. Doomedpod.com and YouTube.com/Matt Binder.
Matt, what's happening on TMBS this week?
Yeah, we had Megan Day in to talk about rural health care and you know, where the left goes after Bernie, and Ryan Pollack on to talk about the labor side of the Green New Deal.
Great. All right, guys, have fun in the fun half, and I will be back tomorrow.
See you later.
Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you. You fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good. Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. Are you guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.